Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. This year, Tech Policy Press is hosting 9 fellows. These individuals, who are located around the world from India to Spain to Brazil to the US and beyond, bring a variety of experiences and expertise to their work. One of those fellows is Anika Collier-Navaroli. Anika is an award-winning writer, lawyer, and researcher focused on the intersections of technology, media, policy, and human rights. She's currently a senior fellow at the Tao Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University and the McGurn Senior Fellow for Media Integrity at the Consortium on Trust in Media and Technology at the University of Florida. For the past decade, her work has spanned from law firms and think tanks to advocacy organizations and senior policy positions at Twitter and Twitch. She was just named Assistant Professor of Professional Practice at Columbia University in its Graduate School of Journalism. For her fellowship, Anika is conducting a series of discussions like the one you'll hear today that are intended to help us imagine possible futures for tech and tech policy, for democracy, and for society beyond the moment we are in. Here's Anika to introduce her guests and the latest episode in the series, which she's dubbed Through to Thriving.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to another episode of our special podcast series, Through to Thriving. I am your host and a Tech Policy Press fellow, Anika Collier-Navaroli, and I am talking to some brilliant tech policy folks, and we are exploring futures beyond our current moment. Today, I am speaking to some OGs in the world of trust and safety, Alice Hunsberger and Jarell Peterson. We are going to be talking about balance and resiliency in a notoriously hard industry. Y'all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Great.
Of course.
Yeah, thank you.
Alice, would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and letting them know how long you've been working in trust and safety?
I'm Alice Hunsberger. I have 2 definitions for how long I've been working in trust and safety. So
give them both to us.
Yeah, as a paid profession since 2010. So 15 years paid, but I actually got started in trust and safety about 5 or 6 years before that, because I created a little internet message board with a few thousand people and very quickly discovered you need policies and governance and enforcement when you get random people on the internet. So I'd been doing trust and safety for a few years before that, but in a sort of volunteer community way, not professionally.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alice. Jarell, I'm going to kick it over to you to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Jarell. I've been in this industry for a little over 10 years at this point. Before this work, I started my career as a social worker and was working with vulnerable populations and then transitioned into public policy. And like a lot of folks who've been doing this for as long as I have, you kind of fall into this. I did not know what trust and safety was. I didn't know that platforms had them. I found myself laid off in San Francisco, and a friend encouraged me to think about it and explore it. And I did some informational interviews, and here I am all this time later, and still loving it, I should say, too.
I love that you said you're still loving it, because we're definitely going to get into how we're feeling about the industry back then, what it is now, what it used to be, all of those things. For full disclosure out here, Jarell used to be my boss along with like 6 years ago, and actually is the person who brought me into the trust and safety world. So I owe so much of this in this conversation that we're going to have to Jarell and to the experience that you have and that you brought into the space. And so I'm really excited to be able to talk to both of you all again, because you've been doing this work for so long. I know trust and safety is like, you know, it's got like really hot over the last couple of years. And to hear you all saying like you've been doing this for so long before, you know, it had this name and before it had these 2 words and an ampersand, right? Like this has been the work that so many folks have been doing. I know you mentioned a little bit about it, but how did you, what drew you into the work, Jarell? You're saying like you had no idea what trust and safety was, right? Like same.
Yeah, I had no idea what it was, but then I realized the reasons I wasn't using Twitter and socials generally at the time were trust and safety reasons. Mm-hmm. And so full transparency, everyone who knows me knows at that time in my life, I wanted to be a senator in California. Like that was my plan. I was working towards it. I spent the majority of my time for the nonprofits working with in Sacramento, trying to get on that path. And I didn't want a tweet to ruin that for me, mm-hmm. like, take it out of context, right? I had heard about all the abuse and harassment that happens to folks, particularly to women, particularly to people of color. And I was like, I don't want any part of that. If I'm going to have a successful political career, I also was concerned about privacy. Where does all this information go and who mm-hmm. keeps it and for what purposes? All of those things. And then talking to TS professionals, they were like, well, Doug, you should be working over here. This is exactly what we think about all day. And so like, I really fell into it and lucked out that I found my people. I'm not an engineer. And most of the folks who were working at TNS at the time also weren't necessarily technical. Some of them had some data science skills, but a lot of them came from government. They came from nonprofits. They came from law enforcement, some social workers too. And so it just felt right then.
Yeah. Yeah. Alice, back to your website. Like, what got you into this work?
Yeah. Similarly, I fell into it. So I fell into the website that I did because I love community and creating communities. I'd done community stuff in person. I was doing community stuff online. It's been the sort of through line for me for a really long time. Similarly, I had another career before Trust and Safety. So I was a documentary film editor, and I did that for many years. But then
multifaceted.
I didn't know that about you either. That's cool.
Right. Yeah. Weirdly, it uses the same skills. So as a documentary editor, you have to look at thousands of hours of raw footage and piece a story together from it and find the patterns and find the why behind it. And that's exactly what you do when you're looking at like thousands of bad actors or millions of bad actors and trying to figure out why are they doing this? Like, what's the human element behind it? What's the, you know, way to make a pattern understandable to other people? How do you tell that story? A lot of the work that I do in Trust and Safety is storytelling, both to users and also execs. And like, this is why you should care. And documentary film editing is exactly the same. But in 2009, there, you know, the economy crashed. Nobody was making little documentaries anymore. I wasn't totally sure if that's what I wanted to do. I was open to other things. And I knew people who had co-founded this little dating app called OkCupid that had 20 employees at the time and needed somebody to moderate scammers. And I had as much experience as anybody because I'd been doing this independently for a while. And, you know, back then, this is like before social media existed. So there wasn't like, the only people who knew how to do this kind of thing were people who had been doing it independently. And so, yeah, sounded interesting to me. So I was like, sure. And then I realized I loved it a lot more as a career when it wasn't personal. Like when I was personally founder of a community, the stakes felt a lot more personal. And when I had like the backing of a company and anonymity to some extent, then it became much more manageable.
Can I ask you all this? Terrell, you mentioned you'd still love it, right? Alice, you're talking about what it felt like back then. What did it feel like back then to be like in the industry that, you know, was kind of like behind these closed doors that nobody knew about, this clandestine kind of thing?
It was wild.
Yeah.
Nobody knew anything at all. Like there are no standards and best practices. Everybody who I've talked to who did Trust and Safety back then, it didn't occur to them that there were other people doing Trust and Safety who they could talk to and bounce ideas off of. So we were all in our own little silos, feeling on our own, trying to figure everything out from scratch again. There's no conferences. There's no shared Slack groups. There's no, you know, way to meet people. So it felt very isolating. And there also, at least for me in those early days, probably because I was at a, you know, startup, I hope that most startups these days actually do have better practices. But, you know, there's just a lot of like ship things quickly and think about safety later, not because anybody didn't care about the users and didn't care about safety. The founders absolutely did. But we just like hadn't learned those lessons yet.
Yeah.
Hadn't had it drilled into us that there were checks. And so there's a lot of just like reactive scrambling, I think. And you asked whether I still love it. I still love it today. I still love working in Trust and Safety. all these many years later, but I definitely would not want to go back to those days. Like, I'm glad things have evolved since then.
Okay. Jarrell, your pause. Yeah, go ahead. Explain that.
Definitely evolved since then. It was also kind of exciting too, because I started in trust and safety at a really big platform as well that people used and people talked about and was in the news all the time. Mm-hmm. And so seeing some of the projects that I got to work on, my first thought would be like, do y'all really want me to work on this? Do y'all care what I have to say about this with this really big platform that means so much to people in the world? And to be honest, I didn't even have an account on that platform. So it didn't really mean that much to me when I started. And so seeing that too, and the intellectual curiosity that I brought to it and the really fun challenges. The thing about trust and safety issues is the rabbit hole is deep. If you
you start digging there.
And I would find myself down these really deep rabbit holes, feeling like how I felt when I got to college for the first time. When people presented me with ideas, I thought I knew a lot about the world when I was 17, but then you get to college, you're like, it is so much bigger than you thought. And the issues are so much more complex that you could work on. And that's how it felt when I started, but scary. As a social worker, we had the National Association of Social Workers to fall back on, with had ethics that we all had to agree to. We all got the same amount of education. So every social worker you met knows how to coach, right? Knows how to do a little bit of therapy, knows a lot of really basic things. And in TNS, we were learning as we were going. Or I think a better way to think about it is we were applying research frameworks outside of our industry to our work and hoping that they would stick to in the effort to try to use best practice when there weren't really established norms across the industry at that time.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you both mentioned the sort of lack of standards and lack of best practices that existed back then. We're talking about, a decade and longer ago. Take us a little bit to present day moment, right? So we have some of those best practices. We have established some of those standards and we're in a different space. What does it feel like now? You say you both love it, but like, what does it feel like to be sitting in this space that now just is, in the hot seat?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways it still feels the same. One of the things that I love about trust and safety is it is always changing. Like you said, there's always new rabbit holes to go down and new things to discover. I think especially now with AI, things are changing like crazy. We're having to think about trust and safety, like moderating content for prompts to generate AI content. And then we have to moderate the output from those prompts. And so there's like all new layers of things that we have to be thinking about in terms of trust and safety that we hadn't before. But that makes it fascinating and interesting, and we're still learning as we go. I think there definitely are places where we can meet each other. There's conferences, there's a professional organization. So all these things that we didn't have before, which means I now have friends in the industry who I can call and be like, this is, this is a problem that I'm thinking about. Like, what are some ways that you've come across this? So that's infinitely helpful, but I don't know that we have all the answers. We don't barely have education, definitely not standardized education for trust and safety people. We still come from all backgrounds. I think that's the strength of trust and safety, that we all come with different skills and different backgrounds, but it also means there's a lot of translation. If people move from one company to another, or they come into the industry, what people think, what they assume, can be very, very, very different things because there's no standardization. That's a good thing and a bad thing. There's pros and cons to it. So I think in a lot of ways, we're in a better place, but I think compared to other professions and other industries, we're probably still closer to those early days of the internet than a lot of other people working in tech or working outside of tech today.
I strongly agree. To the point of professionalization, I remember when I first started in trust and safety, Instagram used to host this meetup for folks in Silicon Valley to kind of come and talk primarily about mental health, and not necessarily mental health for practitioners, but mental health as it relates to moderating online content. And it felt like, although it was at Instagram, it had a really nice office, it felt like this like hodgepodge of folks. And then when I look back on it, I'm like, these are some of the big names in trust and safety right now. We all used to meet in a small conference room with little sandwiches and have experts come talk to us about the fact that our users are on a mental health spectrum. And if you're enforcing your policies, not knowing that people have depression, not knowing that people are having manic disorder, like all of those things. And it just felt like, wow, we are on the vanguard by just even having these conversations at this point. And I think, again, in the context of like social work practices, these standards have been existed for a very long time, or journalists too, which I know is where you come from. And it gets like, mm-hmm. these things have been around for a very, very long time. Us figuring out now is fantastic for the industry, but late in the in the game. And the other thing I would say about how it feels right now is it's complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, like I always start my day with gratitude. I'm grateful to have a job. I'm grateful to work on things that are impactful, that mean a lot to me. There are a lot of really strong trans-safety professionals who are out there who do not have a job right now or who are worried about their career. So gratitude first, but there's a lot of polarization among people, and it's not unique to one or two countries. It's everywhere. There's a lot of tension and fear about global economies, about technology, about climate disasters, right? We are seeing one play out in front of us right now, too, where there's a lot of loss of life. There's all kinds of wars. And trust and safety folks have to sit at the center. We can't ignore it because these conversations are happening online in content and in interactions. And so exciting, fun, all of those things. I still love it, but it is still complicated. It has not gotten any easier for us.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, right? I think that is one of the things that I don't know that I was necessarily prepared for, right? Before I went into working in trust and safety, was kind of being in the middle of that space. You mentioned this sort of like small room, this like little room, this little vanguard, right? And I didn't think I would understand what it felt like in some ways to kind of be isolated, right? And to be, you know, this kind of group of folks who were doing this work that nobody really knows about, but everybody has opinions about. I mean, you know, Jarrell, we worked at a place. I had a whole Slack channel that was dedicated to the entire company being able to express their opinions expressly about the things that our team was doing, right? And so this sort of, there was no winning coming from anywhere. And to say, you know, I've been working in academia these days and I was having a conversation with colleagues at a, you know, school that has been going through some things. And they were saying, you know, where, you know, we have folks that don't want to work with us. And we have these folks that are writing petitions and, you know, like people just don't understand that it's just like good people, like sitting inside of a place trying to do good work. And like, I was sitting over there and I started like kind of laughing and I was like, hey, now you know what it feels like to work in trust and safety, right? Like, now you know, like what that sort of that thing is like. And I think that it is something that a lot of folks don't understand and they see it as sort of a, I think it comes off as like a protection mechanism, right? Or something like an armor and a guard. And I don't think that folks really understand the sort of depth of the centeredness of the world, right? That that we end up being in those spaces. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
100%. And it was surprising to me as well, but it wasn't new. And I'll never forget a recruiter, this was years ago, had reached out to me and saw that I was a social worker and saw that that was what my master's is in. And basically, she was like, well, help me understand how you could add value to my company, because all social workers do is take people's kids away. I was just like, no, she didn't. Like, she also doesn't have any social workers in her universe, right? It was very obvious. Two social workers do a lot of things in this world beyond that. And so being in TNS and having people not understand your work or why it matters or not, at least on face value, know anyone who does this wasn't new for me, but also still, it's a bit unexpected, right? And I think that's one of the things that when I think about what drains me, that is one of the things that drains me. Still having to help folks, even at companies that have trust and safety teams, know that these teams exist and we're not just waiting to be activated in the wings. You know, I push back on like all those Avengers stuff. Like, I'm not just waiting somewhere for a catastrophe. We are always writing. We're always researching. We're always thinking in these rabbit holes, always protecting, even when no one knows. We're always
doing
that part. It's draining to have to do that PR, I think, as Alice described it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even what you just said, like, it's really hard to prove your value when you do your job right and nothing happens. When you're noticed and trusted in safety, it's usually not for a good
reason.
Yeah. But then it's really easy to be taken for granted and to be kind of set aside. And it's draining to have to, you know, fight for continued resources to prove that you're not a cost center. And frankly, like, I don't know if it's better. Now everybody has an opinion about trust and safety. It's been, you know, the last couple of years, just in the political climate that we have, especially in the US, like everybody's thinking about censorship and moderation and big tech. And it's a thing that everyone's thinking about and everybody knows about trust and safety. Whereas when I first started 15, 20 years ago, people were like, wait, there's you. Look at my account and decide whether I'm breaking rules. Like, what on earth are people who do that? Like, nobody had any idea. And that was exhausting, too, to, like, explain that your job even exists. And now it's exhausting explaining why your job exists for a good reason. I don't know which is worse. They're both bad.
Yeah, yeah. I think the sort of, you know, trust and safety are, like, these two great concepts, of course, that were like put together. But I think the reality is that you don't necessarily feel trust or safety, but you feel the absence of both, right? And so when you're doing the job well, you're not getting the requests for comment from the New York Times on how amazing and how safe people are and the days that went by that no catastrophe happened, right? But, you know, you are definitely in the space of consistently having to be on the front lines of dealing with everything, as you mentioned, Jarrell, the things that are happening in the world. So let me ask you all, given all of this, given the polarization, given the complexity, why do you still choose to work in the industry?
For me, this work is still important. People still live a big part of their lives online and they have to engage with others. And it doesn't feel like it's going to go away. And so there's a lot happening there. And we talked about how complicated this is. We talked about the changes in technology, political landscape, all of those things. It keeps me excited. And a lot of times, it's not always healthy. We'll talk about resilience and well-being
later,
but I'm always like, if not me, then who? And I think as a social worker, I bring a very unique and interesting perspective to how we do this work that is inclusive, that is people-centered, right? Not just people as end users, but also our partners, people who review content, the people who write the policy, people who enforce it, people who defend it on public policy teams. And I worry sometimes that there is always a risk that I could, or people who think like me could be replaced, right? With folks who care a lot less, who just want to make money in tech. And I think our industry invites lots of really good democracy-oriented people here, but not always as well. And so I'm like, if I left, or I think one of my goals, things I want to leave behind is lots of folks who are thinking and doing this work for the right reasons. And that keeps me excited and keeps me here because I see it happening.
Yeah. What about you, Alice?
So well said. I agree. I have a lot of very strong opinions and not everybody's implemented them, so I feel like my work isn't done yet. When everyone has perfect policies at every platform, then I can retire. I think, too, another thing that keeps me coming back, I mean, beyond feeling like I have an impact, feeling like I'm doing a good job, feeling like I do have some kind of natural resilience that many others don't, that enables me to keep doing this work, it's the community, like the people that I get to talk to, the people that I get to work with and collaborate with, conversations like this. It's so like healing and gratifying, and I don't know, I would miss going to a job that has less impact and less of, because the stakes are so high, we all have to take it so seriously and we all care so much. And that feeling of being in it together, maybe it's like slight trauma bonding, which maybe again is not the most healthy thing. But you know, that feeling sucks you in, it keeps you going.
It sure does.
That's part of it.
Yeah, yeah, Darrell, you said that there's, you know, good work still to be done. And that reminds me of something that one of our old colleagues, Olivia Conti, said, I think, on LinkedIn the other day. She was talking about, you know, Meta had their chatbot that was having their sexual conversations with minors and was saying, you know, I think the Wall Street Journal called it like an extensive lobbying campaign that happened internally, right? And Olivia was saying, like, what that actually is like individual contributors who are working inside of a trust and safety team who are burning their own social capital, who are working behind the scenes, that are quietly escalating these concerns over and over and over again, right? And the reality that even in this moment when we recognize the sort of rollback that has happened, that power still works. And I hear you, Jarell, in the like, what happens if those folks aren't there? What if folks like you all aren't there anymore? So speaking of the rollback of policies, we all know this has been happening, right? Trust and safety teams have been pulled back and fired, and so many things are going on. And we have recognized that, I think, you know, I was talking to someone the other day and told them, you know, oh, well, you know, what did you used to do? And I mentioned I worked at Twitter, wrote the policies. And I said, really, like, well, everything you wrote must have been like gone by now, right? And I'm like, well, yes, like that is, as a matter of fact, that is the place that we are currently in. And they're like, how do you feel about that? Right. And I think, you know, I have my own feelings, but I would love to ask y'all. I think we all identify as members of the Alphabet Mafia over here. Yep. So, you know, we see what's happening to our community, right? And like, how does it feel to be sitting here in this moment and recognizing what's going on?
It's hard. It's hard. No one has asked me that question. This is my first time kind of verbalize actually how I feel, but I think hard is the best way to describe it. And primarily because I think about how much work goes into policy development if you're going to do it at scale in ways that are like consistent and fair. People always ask me, well, just write a new policy. Like, why are we having to just write a new policy? And then I'm like, okay, great. We'll write a new policy. Here's the timeline. And they're surprised when it's months long. And they're like, well, isn't writing just typing it on your computer? And it's no. Drafting language is obviously part of it, but there's the research piece, right? There's the industry assessment. How are other platforms handling this? Are there best practices out there? Just feedback collection from legal and public policy and government affairs and enforcement teams too. There's testing it against thousands of examples and lots of different languages to ensure that we can like replicate this. And in some cases, Anika knows well, this is getting explicit sign off from executives across the whole company
group.
And these executives sit in different parts of the world. So we are getting so much alignment. And so to see policies and processes be rolled back without the same amount of rigor and consideration, that is the part that's hard. Because again, it implies that like these were just words that were written and now they are no longer here, right? And that's not how we think about lawmaking. That's not how we think about the Constitution, right? And so it's just, it's that part, I think, is the part that really makes this challenging to see.
Yeah. Alice?
I haven't had the same experience. As far as I know, none of the major policies that I've written have been totally rolled back. So I haven't gone through that level of grief, but I'm sure it'll happen someday. Maybe it's happened and I just don't choose not to look and know about it. But, you know, collectively looking at all the hard work that people have done at platforms and sort of being an outsider looking in and seeing these things roll back and knowing how much care is put into it it's heartbreaking for all of us, especially when you know things can be better, like they were better. I think that part feels really frustrating. And I think your point about things being rolled back without the same level of rigor or thought is definitely like a pattern that I've seen and heard about. And I think that's the part that hurts the most. It's like, if you're going to put hateful, bigoted policies in place, like at least measure what their impact is going to be and own up to it, you know?
One of the things you said earlier, though, Alice, that really stuck with me too. It's like you were half joking, but you were like, not everybody listens to me when I say it too. And it's something that I think is an underrated or under talked about skill in our industry, and it's influence. We can be smart and we should be practitioners and we should be metrics and data driven, but the way you get companies of thousands of people to change is by building relationships and asking questions in the right way, connecting the dots for folks and constantly educating and hitting them over the head. And that's something that I think I would want more people to lean into, even if you're the smartest person in the room, to get a company to think differently and be accountable for harm simply because their platform exists is hard to do. And research can only get you so far. Relationships and showing up as like a trusted stakeholder who people can depend on actually is what changes the dial and the temperature internally. So I'm right there with Alice. Like, y'all gonna start listening to me eventually, right? But it's not the case.
Well, 100% to all of that. This also might be a little bit of a tangent, but
let's go.
I'm going to go for it. I think that we as the tech industry, social media are moving, have moved, already are in a space where platforms are no longer always trying to be one size fits all, one bland generic policy for every single social media platform that's exactly the same. We're seeing platforms differentiate often based on CEO values. And I think that's going to happen more and more, but that also leaves open room for people to create and advocate for policies that are even more inclusive, even more thoughtful, even more freedom-based, but also human rights-based.
Yeah.
And something that I try to do as much as I can is like share what I've tried, share what I think works, share what I've done. When I was at Grindr, I was trying to push some of the nudity policies forward as an industry because I felt like we could push the boundaries a little bit more than other people could. But I documented all of it and I wrote about it and I said, here's how we did it. Here's all the safeguards we had to put into place. And so even if you are at a relatively small platform, I think pushing back and also sharing can push forward other people and sort of give them the cover and say, oh, hey, these other people did this. It's something that exists. Like, this policy is a good idea. So as an industry, we can all do it together. Even, you know, I'm not at a platform anymore and I still have lots of opinions about policy and I write about it all the time. But I found people sometimes are scared to say these things out loud or to have really strong opinions. It definitely can have an effect on your career. You know, like, yeah, there are places where I will probably never be hired because of the things that I've said.
Same, girl.
Yeah. And it's okay. It's all good.
I appreciate that. You said something in there, Alice, which I just want to acknowledge what you mentioned, like the grief, right? And the hurt that comes along with so much of this work, right? And I would love to talk a little bit more then about, in feeling these very complex feelings that are very, very deep, how do you all find balance or resilience or the ability to not just survive, but to thrive and still be in this place within trust and safety?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that come to mind for me. I always try to be future oriented. I used to get the question all the time, and the question was, how do you sleep at night? Knowing that all these things are happening, knowing that all this stuff is bad, knowing that I just told you I had a really horrible experience on your platform, that's the worst thing in the world. Like, why'd you even create it? And for me, what kept me asleep is I knew where we were going. I had visibility into our roadmaps. I knew that things were going to get better, that help was coming for certain issues. I knew what we were thinking about. And I try to always focus on the future because I can work backwards. Like, here's how we're going to make sure this never happens to somebody else or to another community or that kind of thing. Future orientation I still use today, and that helps. But I encourage folks to also be curious about the complex ways that we can manage some of the issues we see today. A lot of platforms still exist in the binary or leaving things up and taking them down. There's so much innovation that's happened over the past few years. I'll never forget, Eric Goldman published a paper years ago that basically mapped all of the interventions that every major platform does. And it was like leave up and take down, plus like 30 other things, multiple categories that they can do, from demonetization to education to interstitials to resources and all that stuff. And I remember how freeing and exciting that was to read. Because I'm like, we could do half those things and significantly improve the experience of users on our platform. And I've seen lots of other very basic interventions being used in really meaningful ways. The example I always come back to, I was literally talking about it today with a senior person on our team, was Netflix. And so you all remember years ago, there was the shooting in Texas of elementary school students, right? And Nico's looking at me like, which one?
Right. Unfortunately, but yes.
The news that was happening. And what was also happening at that time is Netflix was about to premiere Stranger Things 2, which was huge. And I watched Stranger Things and we were glued and ready for it to come up so we could stream it. And I'm sure there was a conversation about whether or not they should premiere it, because the first scene started with what seemed like kids being killed in a school. Now, obviously, no one could have predicted that. I'm sure there were questions about, should this be here or not? Are we going to promote it? And what Netflix did was put it in a digital. It's like, hey, this may be sensitive for folks, because it was untimely, because it would be really concerning for people. And that was a choice that said a lot about what the company stands for and what they want to be in the world, but also gave folks a heads up, because this was unfolding in a way that folks couldn't anticipate. And for me, no platform is perfect, but that's an example that encouraged me to push people in thinking about, like, for a teenage person, they're always like, do I have to take this down, is the first question. And what is my argument for or against, as opposed to what are the other ways that we can show up for communities, or platforms can show up for communities that they care about and invest in, or keep people safe beyond just those difficult conversations? Because it's always a high bar, regardless of where you work, saying that this content shouldn't exist or be accessible in any way is a really, really high bar for platforms. I think they host the world's information or the world's music or the world's content too.
Yeah. Alice, did I hear you correctly when you said buy more plants? Is that what you said?
I don't know if I ever said that.
Okay. I'm sorry. Maybe that's me over here just like projecting onto you.
I mean, I do. I love gardening and cooking. Those are like my two de-stressing things, to do something with the senses and my physical body. I go for long walks in the woods. I live in the middle of the woods. I don't live in a city. Having that balance in my life where when I'm done with work, I'm done with technology is really, really helpful, especially because I self-sabotage, because my main hobby is trust and safety, and my job is also trust and safety. So I do all kinds of trust and safety stuff like outside of my 9-to-5. So I really need to unplug when I'm done. I love what you said about being forward thinking. I think remembering the impact that I've had and the things that I've changed for the better is so helpful when I'm feeling hopeless about the state of things. And then, you know, I've also tried to have variety in the work that I do and the kinds of things that I do. The last couple of years, you know, I was at dating apps for 13 years, and I was like, I need to do something different and just scratch a different itch. And that's been really, really helpful for me. Being on the service provider side of things comes with its own set of stresses, but I work for a trust and safety company. We do not have to justify why trust and safety is important. Like, we exist for trust and safety. Like, the CEO loves trust and safety. Like, that is what we do all day. I don't have to justify my existence at all. And that is actually a huge mental burden that has been lifted. So just being intentional that, like, that's what I needed at this time in my life and my career was, like, to not justify my existence. That's been really helpful as well. And then, you know, I think the last thing is just always coming back to community again, trying as much as possible to connect with people and stay curious and say yes to random meetings when I can and chat with people and make new friends and feel less alone and feel like I can mentor and be mentored and learn new things and teach new things. All of those things keep me motivated and interested and kind of zoomed out a little bit and less in my own head about whatever daily problems I'm dealing with.
I appreciate
y'all. Plus one, the community.
Yeah. I appreciate y'all sharing that. I think the remembering the impact that you've had, right, is something that really resonated with me. I think I worked in academia and industry and civil society and, you know, been around. And I consistently look back on the work that I did in trust and safety as some of the most impactful that I was ever able to do. Just being able to like directly have my hands on the work. I have a couple more questions that I want to ask you all. One, just saying, you know, having worked in all of these various places and working in tech policy, how do we, right? How do trust and safety folks, how do folks within industry work better with folks who are within academia, with folks who are in civil society, with folks who are coming from nonprofits, right? How do we work better together? Since I recognize that so many of us have the same goals, right? And are working towards the same ends and don't necessarily end up working that well together historically.
Yeah, such a good one. I had a conversation with Jenny Olson from GLAAD about this. She and I collaborate a lot on she's things. Great.
We've become, shout out to Jenny. Yes.
Yeah. Shout out. Love you, Jenny.
But she always jokes that her job is to yell at people at platforms, but like in a nice way. And I think there's a lot of people who feel like that's their job. But I'll say somebody who is at a platform doesn't feel good to be yelled at.
Nope.
Especially if you are somebody who deeply cares and is trying to do their best and trying to use, like, you know, you were talking about earlier, like the scrap of influence that they have, the scrap of power. They're using it all up to advance your ideas. And then to be told, like, the company you work for is evil and you guys don't care. It's like, well, there's always people who care. There's always people who are trying. And so, you know, I think like my biggest advice is to remember the company as a whole, like capital letters, the company is not the individuals who work there, and that back channel conversations and just like meeting each other as humans are things that actually can often drive change in a way that the official meetings can't. And that goes both ways. Like if you're a trust and safety person and you're working on a policy, reach out and ask people's advice and be clear about what you personally can and cannot promise and can't deliver. But there's tons of people out there who are just like desperate to have some hand in helping platforms be better. And so take advantage of that as well.
Yeah. As someone who has been yelled at a lot by industry groups, by journalists, by government actors, all kinds of folks, I think taking yourself out of it and realizing that there might be something there. And when you work within a company, it's like, oh, they ran a campaign against us. They're horrible. And it's like, there actually might be something there for us to unpack. And this is the tool that they have, right? And we can't deny that a lot of our rights that we exist today were because people use those tools to bring awareness and then bring change and put accountability on institutions, right, too. So that's their tool. And so I always, again, go back with curiosity. If they're making such a big fuss about what is that kernel of truth that we're not meeting an expectation or a standard, et cetera, and we can sit with that for a bit. And in most cases, actually something to be done, too, because of the scale we work with, we miss a lot. And so I think that comfortability, but I also, to your question, Nika, think we have to be intentional about this. I've been to a lot of meetups in the Bay Area, abroad, and definitely in New York, where these folks come together and we're really good at identifying challenges in those venues. And we all agree around the challenges. What we don't usually agree is what to do around them. And I like the hackathon approaches to this work. I saw that Wikimedia just did something at the UN where basically they had all these folks in the room and were like, we're going to update these thousands of pages to make sure there's accurate information about really important topics there too. I also went to one, this was years ago, I think it was a CHI conference, and maybe it was like Montreal or Quebec, but it was the same thing. There were researchers from major platforms in trust and safety. There were all the folks that we see on every safety advisory council and oversight board, all those folks in the room, plus some industry people. And we just solved problems. And half of the things I got a lot of credit for in my career came from those hackathons. I was like, this is stuff that I'm really proud to implement here, but this was not my idea. This came from someone else who was really, really smart. And then we problem solved in a whiteboard with a lot of other smart people from different walks of life to find ways that could stick and land. And not all the things have been implemented, but many. And so I'd love to see a lot more of that happening.
Yeah.
I also think we can be more upfront about trade-offs. One of my biggest pet peeves with folks who are in these advocacy groups in general is they often have very niche things that they care about, which is great. We need specialists. We need people who deeply understand specific issues. And also, when you are at a platform, there are trade-offs between safety and privacy. You increase one, the other might get worse. So there's trade-offs between freedom of expression and safety. Some people feel more safe when they're able to be totally anonymous. Other people feel really unsafe when there are anonymous people around and they don't know who they are. You can't have both. You know, I think that's something that people who are, you know, have this tunnel vision view often feel completely unwilling to compromise or to trade off things. We see this in, you know, in child safety as well with, say, privacy concerns. And it's a tough one because everything, you know, it all matters. It's all important. And we're trying to balance this as best we can as trust and safety professionals. And I think that those really uncomfortable trade-offs where nothing feels good, there's no answer that feels right, there's no solution that makes everybody happy. Those are things that we get used to doing, that we sit with every day. But people outside of trust and safety who don't have to make those trade-offs or hard decisions, they don't understand how heartbreaking it is and how difficult it is and how unhappy we are. But there's no other way. So I think the more that we can talk about that and, you know, give clear examples, even which people at platforms probably aren't going to do much of, but I think that helps people kind of understand and find ways to collaborate that maybe compromise a little bit more.
Plus 1,000, we need to be more transparent around the trade-offs. And I tell my team all the time, like, I'm not explaining our approach or giving the example, expecting someone to agree. We have experts come talk to us all the time and they don't agree what should be done. But I want you to understand. I want them to understand the trade-offs that we're making, because from there, we can have a much more productive conversation around what we can do here when you understand where we're coming from. And we could lean in a lot more, I think, as an industry. And then everything we do, especially if we're thinking about publishing policies in our approach externally, talk about the trade-offs and give examples there too.
Yeah. I'm thinking about a lot of the words that have been used during our conversation today, and some of the ones that you just said, Alice, which were heartbreaking and unhappy. And we also mentioned grief. We also mentioned hurt. We also mentioned happiness, right? And joy and impact and all of these things that are very full and very, very big emotions. And so I would love to ask you all, as we close out this conversation, you know, the future of trust and safety is, you know, people are opining about that every single day. But I would wonder, what sort of advice or what would you tell someone who is thinking about, you know, coming into the industry of trust and safety for the very first time and beginning this work that so many of us have done for so many years? What would you tell them about the work? And especially, this is another question that I've been asked, so if you wouldn't mind also just kind of throwing this one in there too. Is it possible to do this work without essentially like becoming personally and mentally impacted? What do you think, Alice?
It's impossible to do the work and not be impacted. There's no way. You will be. You absolutely will be. This work is rewarding and amazing and also heartbreaking and traumatizing. It's all of these things at once. I think, like you were talking about earlier, there's no way to know exactly what it's going to feel like until you jump in and do it. And so be gentle with yourself, be kind to yourself, be careful, talk to people, have a sense of what you're getting into as much as you can. You know, I think just as you will be affected, one thing that I've learned a lot over the years is I think there are some people who are naturally more resilient for one reason or another. And there are some people who are more likely to be impacted for one reason or another. And, you know, corporate wellness programs are all well and good, but like, they're not going to fix somebody and suddenly turn them into like a trust and safety superhero if they fundamentally are incompatible with this kind of work. And, you know, similarly, there's people like myself. I've been doing this for 20 years. By and large, I'm fine. It's not because I have like the one magic trick that everybody needs to know, or that there's the one magic wellness program, like, I don't know, 5 minutes of meditation a day and my problems are solved. Like, I can't explain why I am generally okay. And so, you know, I think just don't blame yourself personally if it feels like too much for you and you have to take a step back. It's not your own failing. There are other people who will care and will do a good job, and it's okay to step back and take a break. And similarly, if you're naturally pretty resilient and you're doing okay, like, look out for the other people. Like, ask people if they're okay. Take on some more burden if you can. Like, you know, just check in on folks. So yeah, I don't know that that's like satisfying advice, but I don't think there's any, I've never heard any advice in this area that is actually feels practical or helpful for every single person listening. Like, it's so personal. It's so deeply individual.
It is. It's really personal. And I think I want to underscore the points around like being supports for each other, but also if you're a people manager, creating psychological safety on the team too, that people can be wrong and being wrong is fine and disagreeing is fine when there's no right answer. Like Alice said too, that is not, you didn't fail because you don't know what to do right now. If it was easy, someone else would have figured it out a long time ago. We wouldn't be talking about it as a team, especially when it comes to my level. Like, I wouldn't be talking about it if it was straightforward. Someone else would have solved it. And so making sure it's okay that people can be wrong or unsure, because that is the nature of the question that's being asked. But then also something I always do is we let people retreat without any kind of fear for retaliation. So Anika knows there were some content things that would come in that I just told the team I don't like to deal.
Same.
And I won't do that. And it's not a question. It's like, oh, that came in. I may not be on escalation this week, but I'll pick it up because I know Jarrell has an issue with that thing. And sometimes that's my entire week, right? Sometimes it's just a day, but building processes for people to be safe and be okay and have what they need, I think is important in addition to all the things that the companies do from a wellness perspective in terms of benefits and that kind of thing. The last thing I'll say is folks should be really focused on their why too, because this is thankless work. People don't know you exist. We talked about that, right? They don't know how to solve your problem, but they have lots of opinions about it too. Knowing what your why is and what keeps you here is important. And I think that can also sustain folks too. Don't just do it just because too. And we need professionals who are practitioners for the long run, not just today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jarrell and Alice, thank you so much for joining me and talking a little bit more about the work of trust and safety, and the emotions that it comes with, and how you all are able to stay resilient and balanced in something that is so notoriously hard. And just to say, we appreciate you. I appreciate y'all. I know what it's like to do that work, and I am so thankful that I no longer have to do it. So shout out to you and to those of y'all who are still honestly, truly on the front lines doing this work every day in and out, because you are the folks that make the internet, even a small semblance of the piece of safety that we have today that wouldn't be without y'all. So thank you. And I appreciate you joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to Anika, thanks to my co-founder Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.